Coming up on Broadway Videos, this week on Broadway, we talk about Music Theatre Wichita's production of Catch Me If You Can. Michael goes back to Pippin on Broadway. Peter sees Pieces of My Heart. Daniel Reichardt at Birdland. The Attic Theatre Company's production of Strictly Dishonorable. And Love and Human Remains at the Peter J. Sharp Theatre. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Monday, August 4th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantiere. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantiere. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Hi.
So just to follow up, we've been gone for a few weeks. A couple of weeks ago, we were talking about Michael's interview with Mary Rogers in the Sondheim Review. Talkin' Broadway got a chance to post that. So I threw it in the show nooks a few weeks ago. I'll throw it in the show nooks again this week. So if you have missed that and you want to go take a read and see Michael's work on the screen as well as in your ears, you can do that there.
All right. Thanks. Apparently it got a lot of readership because, you know, unfortunately, the timing of her sure. death. Sure. I was really glad that I got to do that. And James, I wanted to compliment you on your interview with David Campbell, which happened at an off time because he is in Australia. So apparently you recorded it at 6 a.m. New York time. Is that what you said?
Yeah. We recorded David's interview at 6 a.m. just because there's a 14-hour time difference between where he is and where we are. And we just tried and we finally said, okay. And I didn't even deign to ask Michael and Peter to get up to do that.
Well, aside from being just so talented, I think he's a really smart guy. I thought he came across as very articulate and very well spoken. And you know, it pointed up to me something that I've only recently learned, I think in the past few years, and I still haven't actually gotten it into my brain, that apparently I've been mispronouncing Sondheim my entire life. Do you know about this, Peter?
No.
Well, apparently people who like work with him, you know, and know him well and make a point of, it's not Sondheim, it's Sondheim. Good and boy. I noticed that David said that, and everyone I know who works with him, you know, intimately or whatever, says that. And the first time I heard it was on Bruce Kimmel's recording of that song, Everybody Wants to Be Sondheim But Me. Mm-hmm. And this was years ago, and I remember him singing, Everybody Wants to Be Sondheim But Me. And I thought, why is he saying it that way? How pretentious. But apparently the H is not supposed to be aspirated. So for all of you who, like me, have been saying it wrong for 45, 50 years, for whatever that's worth, if you want to appear in the know, it's Sondheim, not Sondheim.
Well, some of our listeners might know of the famous, I don't know if he still does it, but if in the past, if he writes Mr. Sondheim a note, he will respond to that.
Yes.
And so we're in the, 2014 now. I wonder if we can get him on a podcast just for 5 minutes and a quick phone call. We have to see if that's possible or not.
Peggy, notice we're both being very quiet.
So, and we had a lot of positive email about our remembrances of Elaine Stritch, and folks really enjoyed the stories that we we told. And they also missed Peter and Michael a lot. So I will shut up and let Peter and Michael start. Peter just got back from, well, I don't know if he just got back, but he was at the Music Theater of Wichita where he saw Catch Me If You Can. So Peter, this is a number of trips you've taken over the years to Music Theater of Wichita. You know, is there gold in them there hills?
Oh, is there ever? I mean, this place is astonishing. I know that the idea of Wichita having an amazing musical theater may sound impossible, but it's been going on for many, many moons. In fact, Wayne Bryan has been doing it for 27 seasons, but it was there before him. But it has really flourished under his reign. And what's so wonderful is that this is the place to be in Wichita. The place has about 2,200 seats. And think of Paper Mill Playhouse, but bigger. I mean, it may have even been the same architect. But enormous place, and the shows are only done for about 7 performances, 1 week, that's it. But boy, they get the people in there for that week. I would say that virtually every show draws 15,000 people, and that's pretty amazing. So it's such a pleasure to go there because they're first-class productions. It's a lot of people who are just starting out. Christian Chenoweth was there once upon a time playing the Beetle-Deedle-Dee lady in Cabaret. So it's a nice place to start. But also, it's a wonderful place to come no matter where you are in your career. And Wayne is beloved. Everybody is so impressed at how he treats people and how he directs. And that brings us to Catch Me If You Can, which, after all, was a short-run show on Broadway. But Wayne wasn't discouraged at all and thought that there was something that should be seen there. So the first thing he did was get rid of the orchestra on stage, and it really made a tremendous difference because suddenly the show had room to breathe. The dancers, there's so much dancing in Catch Me If You Can. And by the way, very, very nicely done by choreographer Linda Goodrich. Because it's one production number after another. You may recall that Catch Me If You Can is done as a TV variety show. Because once Frank Abagnale Jr. gets caught, he tries to take himself out of his body by thinking of his life as a show. Because his Javert, Carl Hanratty, happens to say, "Don't put on a show for these people," meaning because he's caught at the airport. "A show," he says, ding, you know, and the audience laughs and enjoys that, that now they're going to see his story as a variety show. And I can understand why Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman were attracted to that idea, because you are dealing with, as Billy Flynn calls Roxy Hart, a common criminal. That's what he is. This is a guy who went around writing bad checks, pretending to be an airline pilot, pretending to be a doctor, which, you know, is really very dangerous. So it's much easier to get behind J. Pierpont Finch, the fictional character who goes to the top by lies of evasions and little things here and there. But when you're really talking about a real person who we know existed and did all these terrible things, well, that's a different story entirely. So they tried to soften it by making it into a TV special. Now, here's the thing about TV specials, though, when you think of it. Think of the shows that used to have the bands on stage. I mean, many of the listeners are too young to even know what we're talking about in terms of variety specials, but there was a time when these used to rule the airwaves. And it was shows like Lawrence Welk, who used to have the band on stage, and Alice Lon used to come out, and the Lennon Sisters used to come out. They used to stand at the mic, they used to sing, and they went home. I mean, the shows that were variety shows where they were singing and dancing did not have the bands on stage. Wherever they were, we don't know, but we never saw them because they gave them room to dance. And Wayne was very smart in doing that by taking the band and putting it back in the pit where it belonged, and therefore so much space was available. So that was a really good thing. The second thing he did that really, because now all of a sudden he has a blank back wall, he decided to make that into a giant TV screen, which was really terrific because he had a lot of images up there of this, that, and the other thing. The show takes place in the early 60s, so you would see cigarette ads. I mean, there's Santa Claus endorsing Camels. You know, I mean, ads like that. A kid who's thrilled to get a rifle. "Gee, Dad, it's a Winchester." You know, I mean, and you shudder thinking, "Here's this kid with a gun." But those were the ads that were on then. So as a result, he certainly put him up there. But also, he had a cameraman who actually was filming these people live, and on the back wall, you would see them blown up tremendously as if you were looking at a giant, giant TV screen. So that was terrific, too. It really helped a great deal. For example, this may sound tiny, but nevertheless, Montrachard is the name of the town where Frank's mother comes. That's an odd word. We don't hear that word anywhere. So there was Wayne putting a map of France in the back with the word Montrachard, beautifully enormous, you know, from you know how they do that with the little dot, and then the word gets very big and spills out over the map. Well, that's what he did. So, I mean, it really helps. All those visual aids really help the story tremendously. So those two things really made a difference. Now, of course, none of this will matter if you don't have a good cast, but he had a fabulous cast because a young man named Skyler Adams was really endearing as the criminal, and you need him to be, you know, because really, as I say, he's a criminal. There's no getting around it. Since I came home, by the way, I read the original book. I don't mean the libretto. I mean the book that Frank Abagnale wrote about his memoir of his experiences. And good Lord, you know, the movie, which I watched too since then, and the musical really distill a great deal of what happened. I'm telling you, in this book, you can't wait for him to get caught because he just goes on and on and on with one scam after the other. And mercifully, this one condenses the scams, and that really helps it as well. But also helping, as I say, was Skylar Adams, a recent graduate from the University of Oklahoma, who is going to be in the Pippin tour. So those of you who are going to see Pippin on tour, make sure you keep an eye out for Skylar Adams. I think he'll be easy to find, and I think you'll be very impressed by him. Tom Sesma, a marvelous actor who's been in everything from Face Value, which closed in previews, and Nick and Nora, which virtually closed in previews, played Carl Hanratty. And boy, at the end of the show, it was so tender between these two. That may sound as if that's a bad idea, but they've been avoiding each other. So, well, Frank's been avoiding him. Carl has certainly not been avoiding. But anyway, they really come to feel as if they've known each other. And there's a moment where he tells Frank that when he gets out, the FBI can actually use his services to help catch check forgers and imposters and what have you. And Frank says, "You mean you're going to put me in jail for something, and then when I get out, you're going to have me, you're going to pay me to? And why do you want to help me?" he says. And the way Tom Sesma says, "Because I'm the only one who can," his voice broke with such emotion. Now, I'm not above telling you that I have a bootleg of the of the Broadway production, and I watched that too. I've really been ODing on Catch Me If You Can, and I'm telling you, the Tony winner Norbert Leo Butz simply says the line, and we all go home. I mean, it's much more effective the way Tom Sesma did it. Paula Leggett Chase, marvelous, marvelous as his mother. But you know. What's really great, this score, Mark Shaiman has really done a fine job with this score, because in early in the show, you hear early 60s music that you used to hear in variety shows, meaning Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin-y type stuff. He does that awfully well. As Frank goes on his own and gets away from his family, the music becomes more late 60s because you know that's his music. At the beginning, you're hearing the father's music, the mother's music. But as time goes on, Frank finds his own musical identity. So it's very clever in that way. So I have a feeling if this were the show, this were the production that had opened on Broadway, they would have done better than the 166 odd performances that they did. So it was a pleasure to see it again, to revisit it. I have to say that Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman came to see it, were tremendously impressed. Mark said, "Oh, I can't tell you how much I begged them to put that TV screen in the back wall. I'm so glad you did it, you know, that you, that occurred to you." So a good time was had by all. The audience took to it. Wayne has often said, "I can only do one Maverick show a year, one show that they've never heard of. If I do two, I'm out of business. But I can do one." That was the one he chose this year. Meanwhile, as proof of what the other shows were, South Pacific, West Side Story, 42nd Street, and Joseph. So so really, this was the one that he chose this year, and he certainly did well by it. And I dare say that the vast majority of the 15,000 people who saw the show were entranced by it.
Well, you know, it's amazing. Newsflash, just the connections in theater. I've never been to Wichita, but the one Wayne Bryan show I saw was, speaking of Mary Rogers, his production of Once Upon a Mattress that I saw in San Francisco years ago with Leah Delaria as Winifred. And I really enjoyed that. That was a great production. And then further connections. I remember a couple of years ago, David Campbell came out with an album of Broadway songs, really fantastic album. The absolute highlight of which is the song Goodbye from Catch Me If You Can. So that's the David Campbell connection. And then the other thing is, as far as Pippin, I just re-saw it on Broadway. So so I guess, you know, good stuff just keeps coming back in one way or another, you know.
So, Peter, I'm looking at the first of all, I have to say that I have been saying Music Theater of Wichita.
Of Wichita as opposed to Music Theater Wichita. And, right? Is that what you
– Yes.
Yeah, and recent. That's recent. It used to be Music Theater of Wichita. This is the first year that they've changed it to Music Theater Wichita. Hmm. In fact, the season brochures say Music Theater of Wichita, while the playbills say Music Theater Wichita. So it's a recent change. So you're off the hook. You haven't done anything wrong.
Oh, I was terribly embarrassed. So, but on their wonderful website, which is mtwichita.org, linking to it in the show notes, they have this thing called the Jester Awards Program. Do you know anything about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. They compete in the Jimmy Awards, too. Two kids come from Wichita to the Minskoff Theater in late June, early July to compete with 50-odd other students to see if they can take home the prize. But it's a fabulous thing, the Jimmy Awards version in Wichita, the Jesters. In the program, Wayne makes a big deal of putting all the names of the winners, and so it's also fun to see what types of shows they're doing out there. And it's yes, there's All Shook Up there, and the Thoroughly Modern Millie, and the ones you'd expect. But occasionally, there's a Maverick one thrown in there too. I guess even high school teachers feel that they can do one Maverick one every now and then and get away with it. But it's a very nice program, and Wayne is very devoted. Very devoted to teenagers. Before every show, he has a teen choir take the stage and sing a medley of what the next show will be. So when I was there, I heard a medley of 42nd Street. It's a big choreographed number. There's about four dozen kids, maybe, all in matching T-shirts, singing and dancing, having a wonderful time. And that's really great, too. Carol Channing, in her memoir, which, by the way, I recommend highly. It doesn't sound like it would be good, but believe me, it is. Does take a swipe at Wichita. Talking about when she grew up in San Francisco, and she said, look at all the arts we had. Can you get that in Wichita? You know, and she just didn't know. I mean, you know, I can't speak for the other arts in Wichita, but I would, if she had been to this theater, and she probably was in Wichita somewhere along the line with Dolly. Don't you expect? Did she miss any city? Anyway, then indeed, you know, she would have chosen a different city to say, can you get that in whatever? Because you can certainly get music theater in Wichita.
Well, you know, I have to laugh because, again, I've never been, but in Gypsy, Wichita is basically presented as the, well, how do you want to put it? The butthole.
Bottom.
The butthole of show business, because
there's actually the sign on the side of the stage that says the bottom, you know, because that's the metaphor. Yeah, right. Yeah. So that they're in burlesque. Right. Wichita's one and only burlesque theater. Wayne drove me by it. He showed me where it was.
Oh, really?
So, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
how wonderful.
Yeah, sure. That's great. Sure.
So, yeah, that's really funny. So, Michael, you got a chance to go back, and you actually paid to go back and see Pippin. So why don't you tell us about Pippin?
I paid, and I'm so glad that I did. It was one of the best days I've had in the theater, really, or nights for that matter. I was walking down 9th Avenue the other day, and I ran into Eric Altimus, who normally plays Lewis in the show, and I don't, I mean, I only know him slightly, but I know him well enough to say hi. And I said, oh, hi. I said, you know, I've really been wanting to come back and see the show with John Rubenstein as Charlemagne. And he said, well, if you come on Sunday, I'm going on as Pippin and you know, and with John, you know, of course. And I said, oh, so I went home and I, actually I got an email from Walter Willison, who has been a guest on our podcast, the actor Walter Willison, and he had been at Sardi's the other day for the unveiling of John Rubenstein's caricature, or whatever word they use for them there. And he mentioned how good the show is now. And he said, and I told him, well, I was thinking of getting a ticket. So he gave me a link to BroadwayBox.com, which I'd never used because I don't have to buy tickets that often, and I just had never used it. So I went on the day before. Actually, I went on the day before. This was a Saturday night, and they had, you know, a fair amount of seats left in the balcony, the mezzanine, I should say, the rear mezz. But I didn't get one then. And then I went back the next day, and they had a few fewer seats, but they still did. And I got a seat for $49.50. And it was the last row, but the music box is not a big theater, and it's a very, you know, big, presentational, flashy show. And I just felt like it was an excellent seat for that money, for a production that I've loved the previous two times I've seen it. And I have to tell you, it was just, it seemed as fresh as a daisy. You would not know it's even been running as long as it has. Eric was absolutely fantastic. He's got a beautiful, beautiful voice. His acting was superb. He was so in the moment, you know, whether in the comedy, the drama. He's incredibly good looking, which gave a kind of a different cast to the role, because in a way I think Pippin is almost supposed to, maybe not supposed to be that good looking, maybe supposed to be more of an everyman, almost a little nerdy, you know, but anyway, it certainly worked this way too. And he gave an incredible performance. And John was even better than I thought he would be. I guess I liked his whole take on the role much better than Terrence Mann's. And I did not actually have the pleasure of seeing John as Pippin years ago when he originated the role. So it wasn't quite as resonant to me as if I had, but I still, you know, I mean, I had the album since it came out, and, you know, to see him come kind of full circle and play Charlemagne, the father, was in itself a wonderful experience. But the fact that he did such a terrific job with it really made it great. And then on top of all that, the cover, I guess, or understudy was on for the leading player, and her name is Ariana DeBose. She was on for Ciara Renee, whom I'm not really that familiar with. And this Ariana DeBose, she was so fantastic. I liked her better than Patina Miller, and even better than Stephanie Pope, who actually had gone on the first time I saw the show, because Patina had gotten sick right around the time that the show opened and missed a few performances. And they were both very good, but she was, I would say she was even better. She seemed considerably younger to me than both of them, and you might not think that would work for the leading player, aside from the fact that some of us still prefer it to be a man. But she was so great. She again, the spontaneity, the seeming spontaneity of it, and I think she gave a more subtle performance in some ways, which you might think, well, should the leading player be subtle? But yes. I mean, the way she played it, it really added to it. And something that occurred to me, both in her performance and Eric Altemus, is that there are many good reasons to see not to leave a show when you hear that an understudy is going to be in, and not to be disappointed and to try to experience it. We several famous stories of understudies and covers who've gone on to become really great stars. But aside from that, I think, you know, it can be a perfect situation in that they tend to be very well rehearsed, you know, in the show, and they're very familiar with it. But the fact that they don't, the sheer fact that they don't go on 8 times a week, sometimes that can make them seem much more spontaneous and fresher and in the moment. And that was certainly the case with both Eric Altemus and Ariana DeBose when I saw Pippin on yesterday afternoon, Sunday. Charlotte d'Amboise and Rachel Bay-Jones were still fantastic as Fastrada and Catherine. And Priscilla Lopez was the icing on the cake. Priscilla Lopez, whom, of course, you know, who I saw in 1975 as Morales in A Chorus Line, now playing Bertha in Pippin. So it was, and I still think it's one of the best revivals I've ever seen. And I urge you, if you have not seen it, get to see it. If there's any way you can see it when Eric Altemus is in it, you will be astounded. And really, it's I can't recommend it more highly. I'm so glad. I've never been happier about spending money in my entire life.
Eric is a graduate of the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where I'm a visiting professor, and he was extraordinarily good in both How to Succeed in Business and Two Gentlemen of Verona. Two Tony-winning musicals, like it or not. Anyway, and then I saw him do The Fantastics here. He was doing that for a while. And
yes, I didn't see him in that, unfortunately, but he must have been great in that.
He was. He's a very talented young man, and I'm not surprised to hear that you liked him as much as you did. And I'm very glad that Pippin is still with us. It's a wonderful show.
So Peter saw Piece of My Heart at the Signature. Peter, what'd you think about it?
Well, you know, this is a very dramatic story. Here's Burt Burns, a songwriter in the late 50s, early 60s, trying to make it happen in the Brill Building. He winds up going to Africa. I mean, all sorts of interesting things happen to him. Frankly, much more interesting things than seem to happen to Carole King in Beautiful. Hmm. And yet, why is Beautiful a wonderful show, and why is Piece of My Heart a terrible show? Again, the quality of the writing, you know, I mean, you got to get it. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. And the book writer of this show is very perfunctory. It's connect the dots, paint by numbers. And it really made me have even more respect for Beautiful, the Doug McGrath that did such a wonderful job of infusing true humanity into these characters. You really cared about Carole King in that show. You wanted her to succeed. Here, I didn't feel anything about Mr. Burns. That's B-E-R-N-S, by the way. Nothing at all. I mean, even though he was going through a lot of trouble, even though he was very ill throughout most of his life and died at a terribly young age, 38. And I'll grant you, too, part of it is that his songs aren't nearly as good as Carole King's songs, and you get to hear them twist and shout, I Want Candy, Hang On Sloopy. But the thing is, too, that Beautiful is smart enough, just as Jersey Boys was, let's just do these songs as performance songs and leave it at that. Let's not try to shoehorn them into a plot. Well, they certainly try here to shoehorn them into a plot. Bert goes to bed with a woman, and she tells him how terrible her life is, and he tells her to hang on. And Hang On Sloopy, he starts singing. I mean, you know, her name isn't Sloopy. I mean, it just makes no sense at all. So that's pretty bad. Linda Hart, who I love dearly, has a very embarrassing song deep in the second act that is almost Springtime for Hitler. Like, again, I do not blame her. I don't even blame the song. I blame the placement of the song. It's the wrong song for that moment. It's the wrong song for that character. It makes her seem insensitive. So this is, to my way of thinking, a show that really makes people look bad. Leslie Kritzer, who's a favorite of mine, it plays his daughter, and there's a lot of drama about being the daughter of this man, and she fights a lot with her mother on this. That's a big problem. But then she just like disappears for like dozens of minutes at a time. The second act, I don't think she shows up for 20 minutes, even though the story has basically been centering on her for much of the first act. Now, this obviously is a Minority Report because the show was supposed to close in a couple of weeks, and no, it's extended. So you can now see it on September till September 14th, you know. So keep in mind that you may feel very differently from the way that I do, but I thought this was a pretty pokey evening.
You know, Peter, I haven't seen it, but it seems to me that I didn't even hear word about this show until after the collapse of the off-Broadway run of the Janis Joplin show.
Uh-huh.
And it occurred to me, I mean, I can't imagine that they wrote it since then, but I wonder if it wouldn't have happened because, of course, Piece of My Heart is
Janis Joplin, right?
Yeah, the signature song. And I think that even, I'm pretty sure that at least one or two people who were in the Janis Joplin show are in this show. So I guess they rescued them from unemployment. So that's a good thing anyway, at least for a while.
Sure, sure.
But it just struck me that it was you know, because I really don't know Burt Burns as a name. I certainly know those songs, but it the timing just seemed interesting to me in that respect, you know.
Yeah, you may have something there.
So,
yeah.
Michael, when you saw Dan Reichardt in concert, did he sing any of those songs?
I don't think he sang any of those songs, but he sang just about every possible style of song you can imagine. And he's an incredible talent too. I mean, so many incredibly talented people we're talking about tonight. He did Candide at City Opera. He's best known as one of the original Jersey Boys on Broadway. He played Bob Gaudio. He can sing. His show tonight at Birdland at 7 p.m. It was great. He opened with songs from the 20s, and then he kind of moved forward. He did a couple of Sinatra songs. He did Bacharach. He did Cy Coleman, and then he moved into like rock ballads, pop ballads from the I would say from the 50s through the 80s, maybe the 90s. The only musical theater song he sang was Almost Like Being in Love from Brigadoon, and he told a really funny story because that was his first professional job at Goodspeed some years ago, and he told a funny story about that. He's, you know, it's one thing to have an incredible voice and be a great actor and have amazing charisma, but on top of that, to know how to put together a cabaret show so well and to be so charming and funny and to have the audience in the palm of your hand, that's an entirely separate talent, which he also seems to have that one. I've seen he does solo shows regularly. He used to do a Christmas show every year. I don't remember if he did one this past year, but I always mark that on my calendar because he does one of the greatest Christmas shows ever. And I think there were a lot of fans there tonight, and he, you know, they loved him, and it was so obviously such a great time was had by all. He told many funny stories, but the one I'll recount is that he said, Jersey Boys was made into a movie, and you know, the audience kind of laughed, and as I think we've discussed it, I have not seen it, believe it or not, but it. From a financial standpoint and sticking around in theaters, it really was not successful at all. But he didn't comment on that. He just, you know, said it was made into a movie and I wasn't in it and blah, blah, blah. And he said as soon as it was announced, you know, that they were going to make the movie, and of course I wasn't cast, I prepared a response for when people would ask me, have you seen the movie of Jersey Boys? And I used the same response that Carol Channing used to give when people would ask if she had seen the movie of Hello, Dolly with Barbara Streisand. And that response was, oh, is there a movie of Hello, Dolly? I haven't seen it.
Has anybody ever quoted Carol Channing
without impersonating her?
The voice, right?
No, and he does her even better than I do, because remember that edition of Forbidden Broadway when everyone imitated Carol Channing?
Sure.
I'm actually not sure if he was in it then, Daniel, but I know I think he was. And he's really great. Catch his solo show whenever, or catch him with the Midtown Men, which has become a huge success. Tremendous success throughout the country. They play all over the place. And I think maybe even internationally. Doing song.
This is the thing, Jersey Boys doing their own thing, right?
Right. Yes. It's people, all four of whom have been in Jersey Boys at one point or another. Christian Hoff is also in it, and then I'm actually not sure of the other two at the moment. But this is the group that started out. Now, what was their original name? The boys in concert or something, but
yeah, they got in trouble.
Sued, yeah.
Right, yeah. So they had to change it to the Midtown Men. But I'm delighted to say that doesn't seem to have hurt them at all. They're really. Are you guys aware of how they play all over and they're
A
tremendous success? So I think they have a New York gig coming up. I meant to look it up and I didn't get a chance. But put that on your radar too, because he's great and they're great. So just make a note of that. Definitely.
All right. So, who was this? Oh, I have it. I had it just a second ago in front of me. It was called The Boys in Concert, a new touring production, former cast members of the Jersey Boys.
I'm not sure if it was the title itself or the subtitle that was the issue, but and I'm not sure exactly who, if it was Frankie Valli or if it was one of the other, but they had to change their name. So.
Yeah, and that just goes to show you that, they changed their name and they still maintained a high level of success. So it's about their talent and the show that they did. They didn't have faith in themselves.
Kind of like Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, that also had to change its title. And that certainly didn't suffer, did it?
Well, that's true. All right. So moving forward, Peter got over to the Flea to see a production of Strictly Dishonorable. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, this isn't quite a Flea production. This is a rental, but nevertheless, they're using the space at 41 White Street. Not hard to get to. A lot of us get a little nervous when we see streets with names rather than numbers because they're harder to find. But if you take the A, C, or E train and get in the very first car, you get off and it's really like 200 steps away from there. So don't let that deter you from going to see Strictly Dishonorable, which indeed is a play that was written by Preston Sturges and was tremendously successful in its day. It's one of the reasons that Hollywood snapped him up. It was a little ribald for its time because it is about a couple that go into a speakeasy. And one can tell very early on that he is much more in love with her than she is with him. And for good reason. I mean, he is this type of man who just believes that the man makes all the decisions and that's all there is to it. And he expects her to fall in line with that. And that certainly was the convention at the time. We have to admit that. Nevertheless, she doesn't want any part of that. And little by little, she realizes that he's really wrong for her. So when a semi-famous opera singer is in the speakeasy as well, she becomes attracted to him. And he makes it quite clear at the end of the first act, that if she stays with him, matters are going to be strictly dishonorable. That's it, So should she go with this man and actually sleep with him? Well, it's already been established that what she's been doing is living with the fiancé already, even though they're not married. Again, hot stuff for this 20s play. Very hot stuff. So it continues like that. But the thing that really impressed me so much was an actor who has the name John Robert Tillotson. Now, he played a judge who is a denizen of the speakeasy. He goes there, knocks back a few drinks, even though he's a judge and he's not supposed to be there. But he takes a great interest in people. And this actor gives one of my favorite types of performances where you can't tell he's acting for a tenth of a second. He's just being himself, a very normal delivery in everything he says. He doesn't punch up lines to get laughs out of them. He doesn't need to. He trusts the material, and it goes very well. So for me, this minor character was really the best one in the show. Everybody else is very good. Don't misunderstand me. However, this is the one that really impressed me with very natural acting. So if you want to see some really good acting, here's John Robert Tillotson. I have to wonder if indeed, could it possibly be that this is the name that a former teen idol named Johnny Tillotson, is it possible? I'm really not certain. But it did occur to me. He was somebody who had a few rock and roll hits back in the late 50s, early 60s, especially one calls it Keeps Right On a Hurtin', and Talk Back Trembling Lips. I remember these songs from my long ago youth. So who knows? I don't think it's the same guy, but the name is so similar that I couldn't help remarking on it. So if you want to see what Preston Sturges, who gave us a lot of great movies, Hail the Conquering Hero, Sullivan's Travels, so many wonderful, wonderful pictures. Hail the Conquering Hero turned into a terrible Broadway musical, or so we're told. I didn't see it. Back in 1960, Bob Fosse worked on it. And Preston Sturges did return to Broadway, including a musical called Make a Wish, which was unsuccessful. But his reputation really was made in Hollywood. But if you want to see how it started, why Hollywood said, ooh, this guy's good, we got to pick him up, Strictly Dishonorable will show you why it happened.
All right. Michael, you got a chance to see Love and Human Remains over at the Sharp. So why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, I did want to just mention it briefly. This is a play that the original title was Unidentified Human Remains and the True Nature of Love. So maybe you can understand why they changed the title to Love and Human Remains. I had first seen it off-Broadway. I guess it was the late 80s, early 90s. And then I noticed there was a film version that came out in 1993 that the only person in it who I think most people would know is Thomas Gibson, who then went on to Dharma and Greg, among other things, because this is based on the play is by the Canadian writer Brad Fraser. And it's a very problematic play, but certainly not boring. And I think it was ahead of its time in the sense of the way that it kind of mixes genres very in a kind of really odd and interesting way. It's sort of a murder mystery, but there's also a lot of comedy in it, and there's quite a bit of sex in it. I mean, you know, not actual sex, but, you know, sexual content. One of the main characters is sort of this dominatrix kind of character, and it really is. If you ever catch a production of it or the movie, it's kind of interesting, even though I don't think it ultimately works. But it's one of those plays that's a good showcase for actors, because a lot of the roles are very meaty, you know, because of the content of the play. And so this was a small production that was done as a rental in the upstairs space at Play Arts Horizons, which is one of the several theaters, as we mentioned, that's called the Peter J. Sharp Theater. And so I did just want to mention it because there was some really good acting in it by, let's see, Francis Brennan Roper, Zach McCoy, Carrie Lynn Miller, Nicholas Baroudi, Paul Castro Jr., Cassandra Paras, and Dan Almakinder, directed by Clyde Baldo. It's really curiosity. Did you see it originally, Peter?
Way back when, yeah. 1991, yeah.
And again, you know, again, small theater world. Today is the birthday of Lou Liberatore, who was in that production and is probably most famous for Burn This, the original production of Burn This with John Malkovich. And I think he was in a couple of other Lanford Wilson plays also. And he's not primarily an actor anymore, I think, but he does still do some things. And he was living in Asbury Park for a while.
That's right. Yeah.
he's I think he's back in New York now, and I just noticed that today's his birthday, so happy birthday, Lou.
Indeed.
All right. So just a few things in the news before we wrap up for the evening. I didn't ask you about this before. I should have, Michael. What is your take on the Met Opera lockout or possible lockout?
Well,
think about what's going on there.
Well, what can I say? I guess in a nutshell, I mean, I've been very vocal for several years now, almost since the beginning about my dislike of the new productions that have come in under Peter Gelb's regime. Almost all of the new production, well, actually, all of the new productions that I saw, except the very first one, which was the beautiful production of Madame Butterfly at the Met that Anthony Minghella directed right before he died, originally in England at the ENO, I believe, and then it came to the Met. And that one is absolutely beautiful. But all of the others, I think every single one of them has been inferior to the one that it replaced. So on that score, I've been very unhappy with him, and then apparently a great many people feel that he's a very poor manager, and the fact that the Met has come to this state where they're trying to cut wages and work hours of the orchestra and you know, some of the other unions rather than to save money in other areas is a really horrendous thing. The Met, the last time I can remember that they went on strike, and I could be wrong about this, there was one in 1977 or thereabouts, and it took them a really long time to recover from that. So I hope things have looked hopeful in the past few days, more so than previously when they looked really, really bad. But they extended the contract deadline for 72 hours, and then didn't they extend it like a week or so?
Something like that.
Yeah. So, so I guess that's a good sign. And they have settled with, apparently, like all of the contracts with like several unions, all ended at once on August 1st. So they've settled with a few of them, the ushers and two of the other unions. But the musicians is the main thing. So I really, really hope they solve it. You know, the loss of City Opera was a tremendous blow, and for the Met, I mean, they have enough problems as it is to weather a strike or a lockout. So here's hoping.
All right. excuse me, Peter, dig into your recesses of your database in your mind and tell us about Cinderella. How long has this been running? Has it been 2 years or 3 years or
at the Broadway theater?
Yeah. The revival.
Not three.
No. It's in its second year.
It's in its second year. I couldn't
remember. It seems longer to you?
It seems longer to me. I mean, we had Laura Osnes and they had some star casting and they had some other things. I guess it's, yeah.
Somebody new's coming in.
Somebody new. Kiki Palmer is coming in. She's going to be the first African-American Cinderella. That was announced this afternoon. And so I was excited to hear that they are forging forward and keeping the show going.
Yes, I agree with that. This is one that Michael and I don't agree on, right? You didn't like Cinderella, right?
Very, very correct.
Yeah, we'll have to agree to disagree. No question about it.
Michael's not going to Broadway Box and getting a ticket and going to see this on his own money.
But again, you know, Peter, you know how much I respect you. And of course,
please, we kind of all agree. Good Lord.
No, but I guess I'm just surprised because it's so different and so much in a different idiom and tone than the original that I guess I know how much respect you have for tradition and of course not that things can't be made new, but I just am surprised that you like it.
So be it, anyway, let's as far as I'm concerned, I'm delighted it's still around and I hope it does make its second official anniversary in January. That will be 2 years if we can make it. I will admit that this has not been a smash hit. Tickets are readily available. And I will also admit that I expected it to do much better than it's done. So there are obviously people who feel the way Michael do. And
well, but on the other hand, it's in a huge theater, and all things considered, it has not done too badly. I see what you mean.
No, it hasn't done too badly, but I expected the demand to be substantially higher, given that it's a show that kids can go see, to say the least. But Wicked it ain't.
Mm-hmm. Well, Douglas Carter Bean is giving us what other thing is he rewriting now? So I'm just not,
bandwagon.
Yeah, not happy.
Maybe he could rewrite Carousel for us.
Yeah, hands off that one.
The bandwagon is going to be done at Encores in the fall, in November, with his new book, and we'll see how that plays out.
Which is so interesting because, of course, I'm actually not that familiar with it, but the original Broadway show, The Bandwagon, was a review.
Mm-hmm.
Which then they used the title for the film, which was
a few songs too. Yeah.
But I mean, the film is very much a story with characters.
What's going to be interesting though is we're going to have to see, because The Bandwagon, as Comden and Green wrote it, was about putting on a show, and a British director talks these American people into doing it his way, and he's very experimental, and the show bombs, and suddenly the good old American know-how has to take over and make the show a hit by doing conventional safe material. They don't want you to think of it that way, but that's really what the show is essentially saying. And what's interesting about that too, that I've always found a little fictitious, is that the director, who has failed miserably, still is hanging around. Believe me, when this happens, they are off. They are out. You know what I mean? Because who's going to watch people look at you either with pathetic eyes or please, you're a jerk, get away from me. So that's the real fiction in The Bandwagon. And Lord knows that Doug Carter Bean is no stranger to the Broadway experience. And he's come in to take over on shows such as Sister Act. So he may bring a lot of bite to this material. So I'm very, very interested to see what his Bandwagon is going to be like. I don't expect it to be nearly as sentimental as the original was. The one thing he better not do, though, and I doubt he will, is drop the wonderful song That's Entertainment, which strangely enough didn't show up in the first That's Entertainment movie. But it's one of the great songs, and I look forward to hearing it on stage in November.
So are you guys going to get a chance to see this Sydney Theater production of The Maids with Cate Blanchett? I think it's the hardest ticket to get.
Yeah, not me. I don't want to. I just,
I understand absolutely what you're saying. It's people are trying to get this one. It's a very, very hot ticket. And I guess,
I have to say I don't like the play very much. Yeah, it doesn't appeal to my sensibilities. So it wasn't something.
We discussed that one, Peter, that was done just about a year or two ago.
I didn't go to that one either. Yeah, I only go to The Maids when I have to go. if it's really an assignment, but
well, it is very off-putting. I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that they would say that's the point, but
sure. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, I mean, and for people who like that sort of thing, it does it awfully well. It just isn't my type of thing.
Yeah. So NBC has announced some of the casting for the Peter Pan coming up,
right?
With Allison Williams, who's from the television show Girls, and Christopher Walken as Hook. So I guess that's coming down the pike. Let's see what the details on this. Do you remember when it is?
December 4th. All right. Yeah. I don't know who she is. And ironically enough, I've never seen Girls, even though my own girlfriend's cousin is the producer of the show. You may notice at the end it says Julia Connor and my girlfriend's Linda Connor. So but I've never seen the show. So I have no idea. I do understand everybody. The first thing that everybody says about this girl being cast is, well, you know, she's quite large in the bosom department, so it's going to be very interesting to see how they tone that down, to use a euphemism. But I think this should have been a boy playing Peter. I mean, if there's any flying to be done, they could use special effects, I guess, that would done in advance, unless they really want to stick to the fact that it's live. Okay, I understand that. But I always prefer seeing a boy as Peter.
And really?
Oh, always. And I like them when they're butch boys, because, I mean, I have to believe that they're leading a gang, you know?
Right. But have you often seen the musical with a boy as Peter, a male as Peter?
I've seen two productions where that has happened. One is terribly unsuccessful.
I think I know which one that was.
I think you do. You know, we
all
do.
Yeah,
we actually inspired someone to go to the library and get a copy of Who Dropped Peter Pan.
Peter. By the way,
he thought stunk. He didn't like the book at all. Anyway, but anyway, what were you going to say, Mike?
Just that, as you probably know, and I did not see that production with either person, but the person who took over for
Robert Creighton.
Yeah, and I would have liked to see him in it.
Me too. Yeah, I think that would have been great, because he's a terrific performer. But, you know, there was a movie of Peter Pan not that long ago, I'd say 15 years ago, and it wasn't the musical. But I mean, my point is, the kids really looked dirty. Their feet were filthy and all that. And this, you know, I believe that's the way it should be. I mean, you know, these are rough and tumble kids. So I don't know what Mary Martin's doing, leading this band. It makes no sense to me. So I don't know. I don't know if Allison Williams is on the Bush side or what have you. But anyway, I have to say I lost a little bit of interest in the project immediately when I heard a girl was going to play the part.
Well, and that the first thing that people say about her maybe about her bosom, but I think the second thing they say is that she's Brian Williams' daughter. So
yes, that has come up a lot. How much it's come up, frankly.
Well, I mean, he's a pretty famous person.
Yes, he is.
That's interesting. Peter, the movie you're thinking of, was it a movie of Peter Pan or was it Finding Neverland?
No. There was a Peter Pan movie. It was British, I believe. I didn't see all of it, but I did see some of it, and I just liked the way that it was gritty. And again, it wasn't the musical. Don't misunderstand me, but still, I like the grittiness of it. Let me see if I can find out what I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I think actually I'm getting confused, because there was Finding Neverland, of course, but then there was the movie with that kid who was wearing, well. I mean, yeah, he was like dressed in jungle. Yeah.
It was done in 2003. His name was Jeremy Sumpter.
Sumpter, yes. Yeah.
So Lynn Redgrave was in it, too. I'm seeing here now. I don't remember that. But anyway, he looked pretty grimy. Finding Neverland, of course, the musical is in Cambridge near Boston right now. And I have to say that my friends who have seen it don't think it's any good at all. That's just what I hear.
Been the problem with Finding Neverland, the musical, for the last couple of years. They've gone through many of the creative staff. I love the movie Finding Neverland.
Wonderful.
It is. And I would have put my money on Michael Corey and Scott Frankel to have done a good job. I never heard what they wrote. Yeah. But nevertheless, I would have put my money on them in a second, because I think they're very smart, very talented people. I may go up there and see it, but supposedly it is on the fast track and we're going to see it, and especially with these suddenly empty theaters like the Winter Garden and the St. James, which we didn't expect to be freed before fall set in. Who can say?
Peter, are you planning to see The Visit?
No, even though there have been changes made, I did see it in Virginia. And while I liked it, I will admit that, you know, I have this mentality of when I check it off the list, it's checked off. I mean, had I not seen it in Virginia, yes, I'd be up there right now, of course.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a case that time being at a premium for all of us, you know, we have to pick and choose. And I choose to try to see things I haven't seen before. And you might say, yeah, then why'd you go to Wichita for Catch Me If You Can? But I knew it was going to be a new interpretation. It's also an MTI show, and I write a column for MTI every Friday, so I want to write about it for that. So, so that's another reason.
I just mentioned it because it's, yes, as you say, it is apparently quite edited from when you and I saw it in Virginia, and getting some really good reviews up in
I'm delighted to hear
Williamstown.
It.
And I'm here, you know, who knows, but I'm hearing Broadway talk again, so we'll hope for the best.
Yes, we will.
So before we go, I have to ask you guys, what week do you guys have? Do you guys have? Let me see. When is it coming up here? Are you guys in October, November, December? Of course, talking about what week are you guys going to be performing Love Letters, because everybody in New York is doing it. So, Peter, what week is yours that you're going to do Love Letters?
And... Yes, I've been contracted to do it the 12th of never.
So. Okay, excellent.
But I have to say, I mean, I do think it's a fantastic idea. That show has been used many times already as vehicles for how shall I say, older performers who might, well, not necessarily, but, you know, some who might be having some problems with memorizing an entire script and or doing a show 8 times a week for like 6 months or, you know, all of the above. And also some people who are not necessarily theater trained, but because it's done with scripts in hand, that opens up tremendous possibilities in terms of casting. And won't it be amazing to have, for example, Carol Burnett back on Broadway again?
So there's a very funny story that I heard about Love Letters and Elaine Stritch, but I were going to let everybody Google that and find out that story on their own, because I don't know the details of it and I can't do it justice, but it's very, very funny. So anything you guys want to add in before we wrap up for the week?
I think Love Letters was the last thing that Elizabeth Taylor did.
Oh, is that right?
On a benefit in L.A. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And the possibilities are just endless. Who else is Alan Alda? Who are some of the other people that announced for this one?
I have to say I'd be much more interested if it were done as a production and not as simply chairs and desks and reading, especially in a theater with over 1,000 seats. It's time for a new Love Letters, not just the way we've had it before. When it was at the Edison, which was a very intimate theater, it was a different experience. But this I think is – I don't think it's going to be very successful, frankly. Even with those stars. But wow. We shall see. Yeah, we'll see. Who knows?
So Brian Dennehy, Mia Farrow, Alan Alda, Candace Bergen, Carol Burnett, Angelica Houston, Stacey Keach, Diana Rigg, Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen, I've never seen Martin Sheen on stage.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Well, I guess
I saw him twice in 2 months in 1964 when he was just starting out. Wow. The more famous one, of course, is the subject was Roses. But only a few weeks before, he was in a play that closed the same night that Anyone Can Whistle opened, but it was the same number of performances, 9 performances. It was a show called Never Live Over a Pretzel Factory. I kid you not. I think that was Martin Sheen's Broadway debut, Never Live Over a Pretzel Factory.
Michael, you mentioned Elizabeth Taylor, and this weekend I watched National Velvet with my daughter, who is Charlotte is 6 years old, and now she wants a pony. So it just it serves me right. It's all we hear for the last 3 days. When are we going to get a pony? I want a horse.
Raising children isn't hard enough. Now you have to get a pony.
Exactly. All right. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If you want to listen to us in another way, you can listen to us on Broadway World. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. If you do have an extra minute, please swing on over to iTunes and leave us a rating there, because it really helps us get up in their ranking system, and we are climbing up there as the number one Broadway podcast. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Night.